And welcome to another episode where I don't have my microphone in the right place of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
My name is Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor today is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in Shasta Lake City, and they're everything John Deere, Ag, Turf, mowers, tractors. They have a great line of steel products up there, and also Honda. Honda generators, mowers. Go up and see them or give them a call at 226-9226 or get them on the web at papemachinery.com.
You're going to say readingtractors.com, weren't you?
No, I was not.
That was our old.
Although you can use that one and it'll still get you there.
Because I made that up years ago.
Yes,
it was
super
handy.
Yes,
I thought, man, that's easy. Tractors and reading tractors. And not to put too fine a point on the Pape Machinery promotion there, but it is that time when PG&E starts sending us out those hateful notes here in the state of California that they're going to be turning our power off. So,
yep, they're going to be thawing your turkey here anytime.
If, in fact, that's coming your direction, you might want to have a generator before you get the memo,
because
it's pretty hard to get them afterwards.
They got lots of them on hand up there. Go up
and for those
them.
Of you in the rest of the world, you know, it's yet another advertisement of why you don't move to California. So I guess it's just a promotion all the way around in kind of an odd way. Also wanted to let folks know that we are also on television, oddly enough. You know, like radio on TV. Yep. KRDT
so
channel Tuesday
23
Wednesday
point,
nights at 10 p.m. on KRDT channel 23.7 on the American Uncensored News. Is that how you do it?
Yeah, I watch it all the time.
See, we actually don't say bad things, so they can put us on the Uncensored News Network. we're not as off the rails as it seems. Show is airing live for the first time here July the 19th, 2020, but my guess is this information will not be old anytime soon, unfortunately.
What do you mean? What do you mean live?
What do you mean live?
We're going to be live?
Yeah, as opposed to, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, actually, we're talking to a doctor, and then we're talking about the virus, so I suppose that is a...
I'm going to have to get a haircut.
That is quite a distinction there. So the first hour, we're chatting with Dr. Keith Smith. We might retitle the show, but right now it's Government Interference in Our Medical Care, which I think everybody has noticed. If you go to the doctor, you'll find out that there are lots of things your physician doesn't get to do because the government won't let them. And I'm not sure most of us are happy about that. Matter of fact, I'm pretty sure nobody's happy about that.
And well, no, they're not happy about it. My doctor told me over a year ago that there'll come a day when he'll just be a state doctor.
Well, and then they came after his license because he continued to prescribe medication for his patients.
Yeah, that they didn't like. So, they came after him. Yeah, so that... That's your state for you. They're only doing what's good for you.
I believe Dr. Smith is going to teach us about that. In the second hour, we have Phil Kirpin with us, who is going to share his testimony to the House Select Committee on the coronavirus. And I know you're probably sick of hearing about it, but I got to tell you, a lot of that information is stuff you haven't heard yet.
Guaranteed you haven't heard it.
And you should probably switch to decaf now.
Scary stuff.
In preparation.
Yeah.
So Dr. Smith is a board-certified anesthesiologist, go spell that twice and then say it, and co-founder of the Surgery Center of Oklahoma. He shows why eliminating barriers between patients and doctors improves health and saves lives. And, you know, I think if we all got in a little room with our doctors, we would have made that same statement. He argues that governors, federal health officials, and other key government actors should step up today to permanently acknowledge the devastating role the government interference has played in reducing access to care, stifling innovation, and preventing entrepreneurship. And he's been on all sorts of famous things, John Stossel's show, The O'Reilly Factor, The Huffington Post, CNBC, The Ron Paul Channel. So he's out there, not out there in a bad way. Sorry, I shouldn't have said that. He's out there. I mean, he's...
What are you saying?
He's been around in interviews, so we're happy to have him. How's that?
Oh, he's been around. Oh, okay.
Stop introducing
people.
Yeah,
just stop it.
Hi, Dr. Smith. He's like, how frightening. I should have done my own intro. I'm pegged for all time as being out there. So I think we can start wherever you would like. We've posted your article, Doctors Must Lead Post-COVID Reforms, and I would encourage people to go and review that. It's on our site at wethepeopleradio.us, and I think it's a great article. So I don't know if you want to cover that or something else, but you just kick it off, and we'll follow along. How's that? since we're not board certified anything.
Well, thanks for having me on your show. Yeah, the article is a reaction to really my renewed optimism, seeing this COVID disaster and the government's handling of it as an opportunity. I think a lot of people's skepticism switch has been turned off, and it's on now. They're hearing the same people say completely different things just a few days apart.
Yeah, and we're not supposed to notice that.
Yeah, I mean, it's becoming increasingly difficult to know what to believe. People that have had, I would argue, a far too intense trust of experts and government officials are now, many of them, scratching their heads and thinking, what in the world is going on? And if they're lying to me about this, what else have they lied to me about? And I think there is a great awakening that is happening. I'm seeing it in the medical community as well as outside, where people are beginning to question, and appropriately so, the statements of known liars and people who just cannot decide from day to day, you know, what it is they're going to recommend or condemn. So in the article, I'm pointing out that this has been going on for a long time, and that when Washington auctions off favors to their favored cronies, in order to hamstring the underdog, you know, the upstart, you know, the newcomer, the person that's trying to mix it up and give consumers and patients more choices, when Washington auctions off those favors, it usually comes in the form of a regulation or a law that prohibits a doctor and patient from interacting the way that they normally would. One of my favorite economists out there is a fellow named Per Byland, who's associated with the Mises Institute and is a professor at Oklahoma State University. And he doesn't use the term regulations anymore. He calls them what they are, choice restrictions. And so in the article, I point out this has really been going on for a long time. And then when you see governors and others step in and ban the prescribing of hydroxychloroquine, for instance, to, you know, an agreement that a patient and their physician should have just between them, you begin to get a feel for just the tip of the iceberg, how devastating federal and state regulations have been to the doctor-patient relationship. The European studies are now all acknowledged, and there are many studies here in the United States now that show the life-saving effects of hydroxychloroquine. And you have to remember, the mainstream medical establishment condemned the use of hydroxychloroquine early on, only to pull those articles out of The Lancet and the New England Journal as fatally flawed and a peer review process that had gone awry. So there's no telling how many people have unnecessarily died because of the ban of use of hydroxychloroquine by governors in particular. And there's also, I point out in the article, it's hard to know how many people have died or whose lives have been destroyed just by the reaction of the government to this issue. So that the article, I think, it's damning in a way, but it's also, I hope, expressive of my optimism, seeing this as an opportunity for people to wake up and realize that the government and the experts that would lie to us about this would lie to us about anything. And I would encourage people to be more skeptical and not take what they're being told without a gigantic grain of salt.
Yeah, never been a better time to do your own homework, that's for sure.
Exactly. Well, that was a terrific lead-in, I guess, to everything else we'll be discussing. We need to take a really quick break. Our guest is Dr. Keith Smith. You are listening to We the People. You can find us online at wethepeopleradio.us.
When they move into your neighborhood, they take over but good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just a body. Then they go, what shall we do about them?
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. We're so glad you could attend. Come inside, come inside. There behind the glass stands a real blade of grass. Be careful as you pass. Move along, move along. Come inside, the show's about to start. Guaranteed to blow your head apart.
Part about blowing your head apart. Sorry about that. That's where the decaf comes in.
Yeah. Yeah. Load up.
Yeah. We wind up talking about really frustrating topics, but I guess our point in doing that is because these things are brought to you in tiny little 2-minute interviews. Yeah. When you see folks on.
Yeah. Just not quite enough information.
No, on network TV or whatever. And not all of the information out there that's written. You don't know if it's good. You don't know if it's bad.
Well, I'm just excited that Dr. Smith is on because I talk to people every day that say the same thing. Mm-hmm. I don't trust them. I don't believe them. And it's that sentiment is getting stronger every day. And they wonder why people aren't doing what they say. They're lying. You know, and you don't know what's a lie and what's true anymore.
Well, okay, so Dr. Smith, I guess that's like the $64,000 question. We should probably adjust that for inflation, but I don't have a calculator with me. But I guess we've been saying that since we were all kids, so it's probably much higher now. But when people are like, okay, for me, I'm not obviously a medical person. When they first started talking about it, it was, oh my gosh, you know, we have this many cases of people who died. I mean, that was the big number. That was the every day, you know, we had to hear about that. And then all of a sudden, it just sort of magically shifted to this is how many people tested positive. And it's like, wait a minute. I don't think I care about that. I mean, that's like saying we just arrested a serial killer with brown hair. Look out for everyone with brown hair. They might be a serial killer. I mean, we wouldn't do that in any other thing. So what are like what would you consider like red flag things that just people who aren't doctors should watch for?
Well, the first red flag was the first thing that came out of their mouth because we were hearing in the United States about death rates.
Is this if their lips are moving, they're lying?
in Europe. Well, yeah, I mean, they were quoting death rates.
Right.
In Europe. And how do you know a rate without knowing the denominator? And there was no testing available. So I was scratching my head thinking, how did they know what the percentage of fatalities that will result from this virus are if they don't know how many people have it in the first place.
Right.
And remember, there was little or no testing in the beginning, and one of the reasons there was no testing was the CDC and the FDA stood in the way. The CDC had a patent on a test that was no good, and the FDA was protecting them by prohibiting anybody else from making it. When the CDC finally released their tests, a gigantic percentage of them were contaminated with COVID-19. So this is an example of what I'm talking about in the article, where without the waiving of these choice restrictions, we would still be waiting on testing. It was the free market. Ultimately, it was entrepreneurs and private individuals and innovators who provided testing so that it was available on a widespread basis.
And I think
when they first started talking about COVID in Europe, they talked about the likelihood that you would die if you got it. And you can't say that unless you know the denominator. If people look into the background of Dr. Robert Redfield, who is the head of the CDC, they will be astonished, truly shocked, that anyone believes anything that this man says. Government is that only entity whose shocking failures are rewarded with more power and money.
Right.
And the CDC is one of those organizations, and Redfield is the poster child for a just incredibly ambitious bureaucrat who has been promoted for his shocking and hysterical failures.
Well, so I think when you look at the CDC, who is supposed to be the premier outfit for knowing what's going on with this pandemic, and they don't even have a test for it, I'm not sure I can put my faith in them from the very get-go.
Well, they had a test, but it was contaminated with COVID-19. And you can either chalk that up to someone being ignorant or diabolical. I don't know which. The other thing you have to keep in mind is the CDC and many states at the CDC's recommendation have been miscounting the number of cases because they're calling new cases patients that have been treated, that have been tested multiple times, and they're calling new cases patients that have a positive antibody test, which means they have a prior exposure to COVID or one of its cousins, the common cold.
Well, then I also heard that the testing, a patient could be tested positive three or four times, and those were counted as three or four
new cases. That's right.
And what about the flu shot? We've actually been kind of hearing a little bit that if you got the flu shot over the past 10 years, there were coronavirus versions in there, and so that would cause many people to test positive.
There are many reasons people test positive who do not have any exposure to COVID-19. That is one that, you're right, has been reported. What I'm telling people is it's really hard to know what to believe. So what we ought to do, and my recommendation, is that we look at our methodology for how do we determine what is true, or at least to get rid of the chaff. The first thing I recommend is that anyone who works for or is funded by government, all of their statements should be discounted, if not discarded. Now, I will say it might turn out that what they're saying is true, but we should employ what Dr. Robert Higgs calls the precautionary principle and assume that they are lying and that they have a conflict of interest. And it may be very veiled. It may be multiple layers veiled so that you cannot determine really what their conflict is. But anyone that speaks for government or is funded by government, anything they say should be discarded. Anyone that benefits from the hysteria that's going on, all of their statements should be discounted, if not discarded. And then the people I am increasingly listening to are the people who apparently don't care about their careers or about the consequences to them for some of the things that they're saying. There were a couple of ER docs in California who finally their conscience got the best of them, and they came out and they made a YouTube video talking about their regimen with hydroxychloroquine, and it was pulled off YouTube, and they were condemned by, I believe, the California Medical Association. And these guys put their careers on the line to get that information out there. And I am hoping that this great awakening, this turning on of the skepticism switch in Americans who hate more than maybe anybody in the world to be lied to, I'm hoping that more and more people will employ this methodology and not just blindly follow the people, the so-called experts, over the cliff.
Where are you on the the whole vaccine thing? Because, I mean, I'm 58 years old, and we've never had a vaccine for the common cold. My understanding is that's also a virus, so shouldn't we have done that a long time ago if we had the capacity to do that?
Well, the vaccine should be all, they should all be looked at on an individual basis, not just individually for the vaccines, but individually as patients. That's the problem with public health. Anyone that has a master's in public health or who claims to be a public health expert does not look at us as individuals. They look at us in the aggregate. They look at us as a member of a group. And so all of our characteristics as individuals that make us unique are truly of no interest to the public health experts. So whenever you look at vaccines, You must look at them individually, and you must look at them as whether they are a benefit for an individual patient. And again, that's a conversation that should happen between a physician and a patient directly without Uncle Sam in the exam room interfering with that discussion.
And that's something that they've been involved in for a very long time. I mean, doctors anymore, it's almost impossible for them to prescribe a drug if, let's say, it was for a sleep disorder and they're going to prescribe it for weight loss. Oh, can't do that. That's not an approved, it's not on our list. So the government steps in and restricts that doctor from doing what's good for you as the patient. Because, like you said, that's not in the group, so it doesn't count. And that's wrong.
Now that's the FDA. The expert, as far as I'm concerned, on the FDA is Dr. Robert Higgs. He's an economist and a historian, and he's made a wonderful video that is that can be viewed at the Mises Institute on the FDA. And he says they make two types of errors. One error is to refuse the use of a drug for a purpose for which it might be life-altering or life-saving. And so people are denied remedies. The other mistake they make is they allow drugs onto the market that are deadly. And so the FDA makes mistakes on both sides. And it's right. An organization, I think, whose time has come and gone. And it's time to have more of a private organization like Underwriter Laboratories, whose stamp is on the bottom of every appliance. It's time to have something like that, or even multiple organizations like that who compete with each other, I think, determine whether or not drugs are safe.
Yeah, the competition or lack thereof is always a big deal. When we come back, tell people about the CDC a little bit, because I'm not sure. I think people think it's totally a government thing, but there's a little bit more to it, which would explain a lot of what they do. You are listening to We the People.
And how they get to patent something.
Yeah. And how they're funded. That's kind of, okay, well, now we're wrecking the whole next segment.
I know it. Sorry.
Stop doing that. So go ahead, try to get a word in it twice. We'll just slide that little thing, and then we can't hear you anymore. Oh, my gosh. Well, you can catch us on the American Uncensored News Network Tuesday and Wednesday nights at 10 p.m. on Channel 23.7 on the American Uncensored News Network. And you can find us online at wethepeopleradio.us.
Went to my family doctor for a pain inside my head. I told him the tunes you left me, I was feeling like just about dead. Well, doctor, what can you give me? And could I take one or two? Can you tell me just what it's gonna do? Will it save me from what I'm going through? Will it ease the pain? Will it ease the pain? Will it help to pacify my brain? That I wouldn't. I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. So good, so good. I got you. Wow, I feel nice. The sugar runs fine.
Can't do a doctor show without that song.
Yeah, there you go. Hey, Dr. Smith, we talked a little bit about. What
CDC.
Do they call,
he's talking about that right now.
Yeah, well, we talked about off-label prescribing, and we had mentioned the CDC, and talk to us about who is the CDC?
And how do they get to decide all this?
How do they get funded, and how do they get to write patents?
Well, I mean, again, that's the government extending favors to themselves and also to their favored cronies. But yeah, there's a significant revenue stream at the CDC. I do not know the number or the percentage of the revenue that comes in from patents that they have on vaccines and other things. One thing people need to know about the history of the CDC is that it was formed with a different name to curb the spread of malaria amongst troops who were headed for World War I, all of whom were training in the southern United States. And so the head of the CDC originally was a fellow from Johns Hopkins, and he anticipated correctly that if this new fledgling organization dispatched its charge effectively, that they would be obsolete and closed down. So he immediately began looking for ways to ensure that the organization would endure even after they completed their task. Yeah. He formed what is called the Epidemic Intelligence Service. There's an epidemiologist in Great Britain that called the EIS the medical CIA of the United States. And so the CDC basically has troops all over the United States ready to wave the flag and say, hey, we have an epidemic. And whether it's real or not, it serves to ensure that this agency, which is hopelessly corrupt, endures. People that are afraid are more likely to be supportive of their congressman or representative funding an organization like this. And so the history of the CDC's fomenting fear amongst the American people is so long. There could be a series of books written about this. One that some people might remember, during Gerald Ford's administration, there was a swine flu scare, which really never materialized, but there was a vaccine that was rushed into production, which killed and paralyzed a lot of people early on, and so it was abandoned. The CDC also was the organization that managed to scare everyone to death with AIDS. The CDC was responsible for the prediction that 20% of all heterosexuals would die of AIDS within 2 or 3 years of the announcement by the CDC that they had, and Dr. Gallo, that they had actually discovered the cause. Dr. Robert Redfield, the current head of the CDC, was the man behind that propaganda effort.
Well, wasn't so Fauci involved? Wasn't Dr. Fauci involved?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so you have two guys now who are standing at the podium. This is not their first rodeo. And it goes back to the rush to find viruses that cause cancer, some of which was successful, most of which was an abject failure. These are people who understand how their organizations are funded and what is necessary and required. If this was the first time that they've been under the lights promoting really hysterical and wrong predictions, all of which have been shown to be falsely high. If this was the first time, I would chalk it up to ignorance, but I'm really having a more and more difficult time looking at these guys. I can hardly even watch them or listen to them because they've done this before, and it's just... It's history that's not real available, but it's out there, and there's no way that the people in charge do not know the history of these two guys, and it's astonishing to me that they still have any opportunity to address people on a mass basis.
Yeah, and I was reading an article that Fauci actually held some patents on some AIDS remedies or prescriptions, and he is now involved in the patent process on some COVID medication. So you got to think that's somewhat of a conflict of interest, but nobody is saying anything about it.
Yeah, and once again, my caution, my advice, if anybody cares, is to examine their own methodology about how they determine what is true. And I believe that the reports are compelling that exactly what you just said is true. So with a conflict of interest as stark as what you just described, how can the man who is promoting A, B, and C be taken seriously?
Right.
So I really have a hard time believing anything that these people say, because they have obvious conflicts of interest. And my guess is for every obvious one, there are countless veiled conflict of interest that we'll never know about.
Yeah.
So if you're a doctor out there trying to treat their patients and they've kind of got all these roadblocks, I know I just had a surgery a couple of months ago, and the surgeon said, it's an outpatient thing, it's a gallbladder deal. He goes, if you do it as an outpatient, you've got to wait 14 days after you take your virus test and all that stuff. He goes, but if I check into the hospital this afternoon as an inpatient, I could do it while I'm on staff tomorrow. And it was like, on call. I was like, oh, that's a good idea. So I mean, doctors are having to be pretty creative in order to actually do the things that they need to do for their patients.
Yeah, and just think about how much better off the American people and the American patient would be if the physician would spend their time and their brain power not on workarounds, on how to get around the government and all of these regulations and choice restrictions, but on actually how to take care of patients and improve the way that we take care of patients. So, you know, I live in a state, Oklahoma, that is, relatively speaking, less locked down than most states, even neighboring states. And I run an outpatient surgery center, and I put all of the prices for what we do on a website in 2009. And the first patients that arrived when I did that were Canadians. Because these are people, in spite of having coverage, as everyone likes to talk about, they did not have access to the care many of them required. People have been flying to Oklahoma City to have surgery because our prices are known. They are out there. Your gallbladder surgery at my surgery center is $5,865. And there are a lot of people that have deductibles higher than that. And so they'll fly to Oklahoma and have their surgery and save money. In states like California that are much more locked down than we are seeing a surge of travelers coming to our facility to have their surgery.
Oh,
and so think of what a waste of resources that actually is. If the physicians in surrounding states would be left to their own devices to take care of patients like they think appropriate, then there would be many resources not spent on travel to my facility and others that have copied us to secure their care. But government is in the way. It's always in the way. There are many states that on a week-by-week basis have reported more suicides than COVID deaths due to these lockdowns. I'm hoping people are paying attention to that. These consequences of this sort of a lockdown mentality are real, and I would argue they are much greater with government's involvement than they would be without.
Well, when you when all this stuff first came with Obamacare, how big of a shift was that from what you were already dealing with as physicians?
Well, in my facility, we have no insurance contracts. We don't care for insurance companies, and they don't like us either. As shocking as that sounds, our prices are a tenth of what our local so-called not-for-profit hospitals charge for the same thing, and our quality is better. But insurance companies, it turns out, don't want anything to do with that. And so Obamacare was actually good for my facility, because as a gift to the insurance carriers, Obamacare allowed deductibles to skyrocket far beyond the prices that I have listed for most of the procedures on our website. So you had these people with these so-called insurance policies.
Yeah, at one point ours was $11,000.
Yeah, and the vast majority of procedures on my website are half that or less. So we have patients that have an insurance so-called benefit that they are financially better off not using. So Obamacare actually caused a surge in our business, and we still see patients that have these exchange plans that come to our facility and pay cash.
Yeah, because unfortunately that whole debate seems to keep going. The language is incorrect. You know, people talk about it's health care, but health care comes from doctors. It's health insurance, and that's really what it is a medical plan that doesn't ensure you care. As anyone with like Medi-Cal, in some cases Medicare, those things often are very restrictive and don't necessarily cover everything. We've taken another really quick break, and we'll be right back with our guest, Dr. Keith Smith. You are listening to We the People. You can join us online at wethepeopleradio.us.
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of years without crying. Now I want to understand. I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding. You must help me if you can. Doctor, my eyes. Was I unwise to leave them open for so long?
Medicine. Yeah. Anyway, we couldn't resist that one. So we learned, Dr. Smith, we learned during the break that apparently if you have access to YouTube, you know, you could save quite a bit doing these things at home.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a YouTube for how to take out a gallbladder, all that.
There you go.
Yeah. 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 Robert was helping us out during the break, giving us ideas. Yeah.
Hey, on a more serious note, we talked about the CDC. Yeah. We got a little bit of time left here.
Sorry.
We talked about the CDC. What about the WHO? What influence do they have on our government regulators? And transversely, do they have any influence on WHO and some of the garbage they come out with?
Chinese communists.
Well, my understanding is the Trump administration has severed all funding to the WHO.
Mm-hmm.
So that is really, that's something to celebrate.
Yes.
We can only hope that they will defund the FDA and the CDC now to make it a complete trifecta so patients can get what they need and not have foisted on them deadly things that they don't need unsuspected. But the World Health Organization has been a disaster for a long time, and kudos to the Trump administration for cutting them off.
Yeah, they obviously were pretty easily exposed as tools of the Chinese Communist Party. I mean, I don't think that was a difficult thing, although a lot of people, I think, might not have known about it right up front. But interesting that we have all these mask mandates. Do you have any opinion? Or actually, you have... opinions are bad. We have opinions, but you have medical knowledge.
Yeah. What about masks? I'm
curious. What do you bring
to
the table on medical knowledge?
A lot of mixed signals on masks.
Stupid mask thing.
Well, there are just as many studies. I think if you were counting them up and tallying them, that show masks do no good as studies that show that they do. I think the studies and information that masks do not, overall, in a broad category, do not protect people, I think those studies are better done. Having said that, whether a mask works or not for an individual, that is a completely different discussion about whether the tyranny of government should be invited to the party.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm opposed to mandates, period. I government is that organization whose ideas are so wonderful that they have to be required and mandated and enforced.
And they need the police to do it, yeah.
Yeah, and I am not a fan of mandates of any kind. If an individual feels like they should wear a mask, then they should wear a mask. There, it again, this is that, this takes us back to the methodology discussion. There is so much information out there on both sides, it is very difficult to know what to believe. The CDC and Dr. Fauci have recommended within a matter of few days diametrically opposed views on masks.
Exactly.
The New England Journal has a recently published article that decries the use of masks and actually says that it might actually make people sicker rebreathing what is trapped in a mask they'll likely reuse. So whatever people think about masks, my comment is that that is a separate discussion from inviting the tyrannical government in, whether it's city, county, state, or federal, to mandate mask use.
But it's kind of part and parcel of the same problem. If they can tell you what doctor you can go to, if they can tell you what surgery you can have, what medication you can have, and they can boss your doctor around without going to medical school themselves, then, well, I guess we can just get some bureaucrats to decide whether or not, you know, you should
wear a mask.
Slap a T-shirt on your face. And like, for people like me, I have really bad asthma. I don't move that much air on a good day. And so to put something over my face, super not happening. However, it seems like in the age of mask hysteria, if you have, I mean, I don't really think of myself as disabled, but that is a disability. It's something I can't control that is a health problem. It's okay to discriminate against people who have respiratory illness now, which is kind of interesting. You know, that's all good. We can do that. Can't discriminate against anybody else. I mean, we've got to fall on our sword to help everybody. But in this mask thing, thou shalt not, you know, go against the edict. It's very odd.
You know, Oklahoma City just passed a mask mandate this past Friday, 2 days ago. But the list of exceptions to the mandate is so long that it renders the mandate actually comical. But my favorite part of the Oklahoma City mandate, when you read through it at the end, it says, do not call 911 to report a non-mask wearer. And the reason that that's in there
is they were
doing
it.
Exactly what's happened in other states where they've mandated mask wearing. People will call the police. They'll call 911.
Yeah.
Karens.
I did.
Out there. Yeah. And you think, well, you know, how did Anne Frank get ratted out? And you're looking at it.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
It is a head scratcher, and I love it that Oklahoma City actually had a plea to everyone to not call 911 if someone's not wearing a mask. It's just, it's comical if it weren't so tragic.
Well, I was getting on a plane here a few weeks ago, several times, but the first one, you know, I have my little note from my doctor, which as a person who has a disability, I shouldn't have to bring a note from my doctor, but I did because I anticipated there would be grief and problems. So I had to show that to the flight attendant, blah, 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 negotiate my way through the door. So I get done with all that rigmarole, and I'm walking down the stupid aisle, and this woman's like, where's your mask?
Oh, yeah.
I so enjoyed saying, shut up, Karen. And then my niece was like, how do you know her name was Karen? lucky guess.
it would behoove people to refresh their memory or familiarize themselves, if they're not familiar, with the Milgram experiment of what happens when someone has power, or what happens when someone is faced with the choice of disappointing an authority figure.
Yes.
And the Milgram experiment is the psychology that shocked the scientist who conducted it. He could not believe the results that he obtained. But that underscores exactly what's going on in the Karen mentality.
It's true, and they don't even know their own rules because, like in California, it's really like 2.5 pages, the thing is, their little guidance for use of face coverings. And on the back, it says the following individuals are exempt from wearing a face covering. Persons with medical condition, mental health condition, or disability that prevents wearing a face covering includes people with a condition for whom wearing a face covering could obstruct breathing. I mean, it's like, okay, that's pretty clear.
That's pretty much.
However, they won't let you in their store, and if you manage to sneak in, I've said this before on other programs, this was in that same trip, some crazy woman at CVS running through the store with her hands over her head shrieking, "She's not wearing a mask! She's not wearing a mask!" It's like,
really?
Oh boy. Apparently that Karen thought she was being chased by a lion, although I was just standing there. They've gone completely nuts. I know we only have like a couple of minutes, but I wanted to go back to that FDA thing because I can hear in the back of my mind, speaking of people with mental disorders, I can hear people saying, well, wait a minute, the FDA saves us from all sorts of things. They make sure that we get things that aren't poisonous, blah, blah, blah. So are you get rid of the FDA, replace it with something, or get rid of the FDA, like let the market take over? Or something
else. The market gave us United Laboratories, which the stamp of which is required for any appliance to enter the market.
Oh, yeah, the light bulbs and stuff.
And that is not a government organization. The FDA, you know, you're talking about the funding the CDC receives. Most people do not understand or know that the FDA receives a lot of its funding from fees paid by Big Pharma. Well, the FDA does not want to jeopardize that flow of funds, so they tend to be influenced by what Big Pharma wants and who Big Pharma does not want competing with them. So the FDA is a hopelessly corrupt organization that makes, as I said, the two mistakes that Dr. Robert Higgs has pointed out. They prevent life-saving treatments from coming onto the market, and they allow deadly drugs to come on the market. If you add it all up, then the net result is the FDA is a deadly, not a protective organization that is completely conflicted by the revenue sources that it receives.
And if you want any proof of that, just look at how many commercials you see on TV. If you've taken blah, 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 call this attorney.
Well,
those were all, remember, approved by the FDA.
Correct. Well, Dr. Smith, we have hit the end of the road here, but we would love to have you come back and tell us some more fun things at a later date.
Happy to.
We very much enjoyed it. So keep spreading the good word, and we love Oklahoma.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Okay, next hour we're talking about coronavirus with Phil Kirpin, and you're listening to We the People Radio. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Good afternoon, and welcome to Hour 2 of We the People Radio. We're here on July 19th, 2020. In case we air this in the future, you'll know when the stuff we were talking about and it was current. So my name is Aaron Ryan.
My name is Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake City. And they're everything ag and turf. So go by and see them. They have a great inventory right now. They also have the Honda generators ready. I mean, it's what we had 112 this week. So
and your grass is mostly dead.
Little north wind, and your turkey's going to get thawed out. So go by and get a generator. Give them a call at 226-9226 or get them on the web at papemachinery.com.
Ta-da.
There you go.
So you can find all the stuff about our program, shows we've done for the past 10 years, actually. Our archives are free to you. The commercials have been taken out. So although we celebrate capitalism, we celebrate it during the show, then take it out. So I guess we're ambivalent there. But you can catch all those archives at wethepeopleradio.us. All sorts of stuff about China that you might want to touch base on. We were kind of ahead of the game on that, and a lot of things on national security that are pretty relevant right now. You can, if you live in the Reading area, you will find us on KRDT, channel 23.7 on the American Uncensored News Network.
There you go.
So, yeah, we're everywhere, taking over the world. Should scare you appreciably. Our guest this second hour is Phil Kirpin. He's the president of American Commitment. I only typed that 100 times last night. I think I'm delirious. American Commitment actually engages in critical public policy fights over the size and intrusiveness of government through direct advocacy. I don't think there's anybody who listens to this program, and I don't care what country you're in listening to this program, that doesn't realize that government is completely out of control in size and intrusiveness. They work on strategic policy analysis, grassroots mobilization. They work with key partners. And American Commitment delivers timely, effective public policy research to the broader free market movement. It's kind of exciting because the document that I have listed for him on the web today is his congressional testimony on COVID-19. It's called COVID-19, the nursing home disease. So there's 16 pages. So I tried to get it so it would feed differently online, but instead
we've all heard, you know,
just made it a PDF for
that on.
Yeah, we've tapped
TV,
on this,
but we haven't got the whole story.
Nope, not to this level.
I mean, I've seen Phil a couple times on Fox, and it just wasn't enough. We just needed more info.
Yeah, sorry, 3 minutes on Laura Ingraham was like, what? Ton more. You should have done the whole show on it. So we're doing the whole hour on this. So, Phil, we're just going to follow along because you've got a huge stash of information.
Thanks for coming on, too, by the way. This is some interesting stuff.
My pleasure. And I appreciate it. It is very hard. The 3-minute segment, unbelievably difficult.
Yeah,
it's so frustrating as a viewer. It's like, now we just got to the good part. And yeah. So, you when was this?
About a month ago now.
So okay, I posted it, but I forgot to look.
My time perceptions are highly distorted these days, so I don't know, you know, 1 week, 2 weeks, a month, 2 months. It's all sort of blending together for me. I don't know if you're experiencing
I think 2020 will go down in history as exactly that.
A blur.
It was last week, and it turns out it was like 6 weeks ago. Yeah,
yeah, right. So it's actually been about a month now, but the situation hasn't changed that much. We are seeing as we see this southern wave, we are seeing more non-long-term care deaths, and so the national percentage has come down a little bit. I think as of my testimony, I had it at 55% of all COVID deaths in the country, excluding New York because they don't report an honest number. I had it at 55% in the long-term care facilities. It's now at about 53%. So, you know, we have seen a better job so far in the southern states of protecting the long-term care facilities, and so they're not yet, and I hope never, I hope it won't happen, but presently they're not seeing the large numbers of long-term care facility deaths that we saw in the northern wave, and so that's very encouraging that they may have learned some lessons and be doing a better job protecting that most vulnerable population. So it's improved slightly, but it still is really the story of this disease, which should not really surprise us when you consider that it was the story of the disease in Europe. Almost all of the European countries had half of their deaths or more in the care homes, as they call them in Europe. You know, we call them nursing homes or long-term care facilities in the United States. So we should have anticipated this better than we did. And honestly, it makes sense because there's such a steep age curve with this disease. Young people, children, almost never get seriously ill. Going up to about age 45 or 50, it's less dangerous, less likely to cause hospitalization or death than the flu. Then it's probably about the same up to about age 70, and then it's much, much worse than the flu above age 70, and it's above age 85 in particular. We have very, very high death rates, and especially among people who have multiple other serious medical conditions, comorbidities. And so if you think about where do the largest concentrations of those people live, people advanced age and with serious medical conditions, they're in the nursing homes because they need the most assistance. And there are other challenges. Once it gets into a nursing home, you've got a lot of people who are living at close quarters. And so you have a lot of sort of poorly ventilated closed spaces, which is where you get respiratory spread. You also have, and this is an indelicate subject to speak about, but you also have a lot of fecal incontinence. And we know that it can spread that way as well. If you don't have extremely good hand washing and personal hygiene and so forth, that can get on surfaces and it can spread that way. And so once it gets in these facilities, it can flash through very, very quickly and with very, very devastating results in terms of the number of deaths that we see. And there were really seven states that did the worst possible thing, that adopted some version of the policy of sending highly infectious hospitalized patients back into the nursing homes while they were still infectious, even if the nursing homes weren't really equipped to isolate them and protect the rest of their population. And those seven states were New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Illinois, and Michigan. And I'll add that California actually had this order, but reversed it after only 2 days. And so California could have gone down the same path as these states that had these total meltdowns in the long-term care facilities. But the difference there, and I give Governor Newsom some positive credit for this, and I'm not a fan of his, so I don't give him a lot of positive credit for a lot of things, but when there was a big backlash from the nursing homes and they were saying, this is crazy, if you send us highly infectious patients, they're going to infect other people, and instead of saving hospital beds, you're going to overrun your hospitals because the one person you sent back is going to infect 20 or 30 more. They're all going to go back into the hospital and overload the hospitals. And California actually listened and reversed course. None of those other states did, and most infamously, New York kept their order in for 6 weeks. So for 6 weeks, they had an order in place that required nursing homes to accept highly infectious patients for post-acute care from hospitals, that actually prohibited testing patients being returned from hospitals, and they returned over 6,000 of them that way, and I believe that was a major driver of the outcome we saw in that state and those other six states that I mentioned. And those states have about 20% of the U.S. population and about 60% of all the COVID deaths. It might be a little less now. I haven't looked recently.
We were also told that New York now, in order to shade the numbers since they're being scrutinized, as soon as it looks like someone in a nursing home is, you know, possibly going to pass away, that they quickly load them in an ambulance. And even if they die in the parking lot or on their way to the hospital, they don't count as a nursing home death.
Yeah, it's really, they have this asterisk. You know, if you look at, like, nursing home deaths as a percentage of COVID deaths state by state, you see this pattern where the states that had really bad nursing home outcomes, it's like the majority of their deaths. In Connecticut, it's 72% of them. In Massachusetts, it's 63% of them. In Pennsylvania, it's 68% of them. And then you look at New York, and it's 26%. And you might say, oh, well, they have a very low percentage. They actually did a better job than people think. And Cuomo sometimes puts the charts up to this effect. Look how much better we did in this measure than other states. But if you look at their report, they are not reporting the same way any other state is. They have an asterisk in there. And you look at the bottom of the report, and the asterisk says we only include deaths that occurred physically within the long-term care facility.
Right.
So to your point,
handy.
If you're outside the four walls of the facility, they leave you out of the count. No other state does that. The other states give you the number of residents who died because, of course, many of them die at the hospital. If they're seriously ill and they go to the hospital, they're hospitalized, it's unlikely they will ever be returned to the nursing home prior to death if they don't make it. And so the way New York is reporting is probably half of their real number, or maybe even a third of their real number. And it's really unfortunate that we don't have the real number, because what happens is you get reports like the New York Times and the AP, and what they do is they say 40% of all the deaths in the country are in nursing homes. And the way they figure that out is they just take New York's number at face value,
right,
put that in the numerator, and they take New York's 30,000 death number at face value and they put it in the denominator. But, you know, in order to believe that only 40% of the deaths nationally were in nursing homes, you have to believe that the New York number is a real number. And the way I look at it, if you exclude New York and look at the other 49 states, it's 53%. Do we really think New York was less than that?
Probably not.
And definitely not half of that.
I hate to do it, but we have to take a really, really quick break. We'll be right back with our guest, Phil Kirpin. You are listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Every night and every day now, never meaning what to say now. never saying what they mean. While they while away the hours in their ivory towers, till they're covered up with flowers in the back of a black limousine. Whoa, la da da.
Now we're back.
Yeah. I just wanted to clarify the advisory that went out in New York. The initial policy that went out on March 25th was went out under the names of Andrew Cuomo, Commissioner Howard Zucker, Executive Deputy Commissioner Sally Dresden. They were the ones, and Cuomo wants to claim that he was only following federal guidelines, which I don't think is entirely true.
No, totally untrue. In fact, there were very specific federal directives, both from the CDC and from the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, that specified that you could not return patients to nursing facilities unless those facilities were equipped to isolate them and protect the rest of their residents and staff. And so the Cuomo order, which required them to accept whether they wanted to or not, and prohibited testing, was totally contrary to federal guidelines. So much so that even I think one of the liberal fact checkers said, you know, he was mostly false, which, you know, for a Democrat, a mostly false is like, you know, that's like the worst rating they can get. They always try to shade everything in their direction.
Yeah, it's just unconscionable that you would send a sick person, as long as they were stable enough to transport, that was positive with COVID, back to the nursing home, and then not allow that nursing home to test them for COVID. They could not refuse them. They had to take them in.
Right. The interesting thing about it also is we've learned, I don't know if we knew it at the time, but it makes sense if you think about it, we've learned that the people who have the most severe illness with this are also the most infectious and are infectious for the longest period of time following recovery relative to people who have more moderate or mild disease. And so somebody who has a really severe bout of it, who requires hospitalization, they could be infectious potentially 4 weeks afterwards.
Right. And they one of the claims they made was they had to send them back to the care facility because they didn't want to overload the hospital. Well, the hospitals weren't ever overloaded, were they?
Well, New York was the one place they were at one point, but I think that this order had a lot to do with it because what happened was exactly what the governor was warned would happen. You know, when he put this order in, the Nursing Home Association in the state told him, you know, if you do this, every one of these people you send in is going to infect 20 or 30 more. They're going to come back to the hospital, and it's going to cause your hospital beds to be much less available, not more available. And I think that's exactly what happened. This is this very short-sighted idea that we need to, as quickly as possible, clear these hospital beds for this big wave of cases that's going to come from the general population. Ironically, it became sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy because they cleared these patients into nursing homes. They infected a lot of other people, and they did, you know, come back and fill all those hospital beds.
Right.
Well, they had these like field hospitals and different things that they built in a lot of communities around the country because you don't just look at New York in this report. You look at a lot of places.
And almost none of them use them. It's a real tragedy because, you know, in my view, almost all of these field facilities that were established could have been designated as post-acute care facilities, and they could have been used specifically for people who were clinically stable to be able to convalesce in a COVID-positive-only facility, so you wouldn't have to worry about isolating them from the rest of a population. And by the way, that would have been much better both for the COVID-negative residents of a nursing home who wouldn't risk exposure, and also for the COVID-positive people in a post-acute care setting, because if you're in a facility that's 100% COVID-positive, you don't need to be in an isolation room. You don't need to be bedbound for an extended period of time. You're not going to have all of the sort of mental and physical challenges that come with extended isolation that you have if you go back into a regular facility, even if they do take all the appropriate precautions. So I think the lack of a good post-acute care plan and the fact we had these facilities that went almost completely unused, even in New York, they hardly used the Navy facility or the Javits Center Field Hospital at all. Those could have been used as post-acute care facilities. And unfortunately, I what I see going on now in the Southern Wave is they don't seem to be using dedicated post-acute care facilities either. They just seem to be keeping people in the hospital indefinitely and sort of using step-down units and expanded hospital capacity until people are negative and they're safe to be discharged. And, you know, that does avoid the problem of sending highly infectious patients into the nursing homes, and that's good. That might be one of the reasons we aren't seeing the terrible numbers there that we saw in the northern states, but it makes it very difficult to follow the hospitalization statistics because you have these numbers. You know, you have a lot of these places where you see the admissions are really flat, but the total hospital census just keeps going up because they're not discharging people. They're sort of
so. Why do you think they didn't use those extra facilities when if their hospitals started to fill up and they knew that sending these folks back to the care facilities was dangerous? And I'm sorry, they had to know it was dangerous. Why didn't they utilize these other emergency facilities they had set up?
You know, I think that the hospitals kept saying we can handle more patients. And they put them in hallways and they put them in, you know, makeshift, converted ORs into ICUs and all this kind of stuff. And from a hospital standpoint, especially when you understand that all the hospitals everywhere in the country have been getting really crushed economically by the ban on non-COVID medical procedures
that right.
in place for such a long time.
Right.
They're laying off doctors and nurses right now.
Don't turn anyone away.
Right.
Okay, don't turn anyone away. We'll find a place to put them. And so, you know, if you don't have the political leadership to say, no, we're not going to just keep sending patients to a hospital that's already full, we're going to start using this other facility in this way. If you just listen to the hospitals, they'll say keep them coming. And I think that's what happened in New York in particular.
Well, and what about the compensation for people who test positive versus regular people in the hospital?
Well,
wasn't it like 39,000 versus 19 or something?
Well, there's a big financial incentive to take COVID patients for hospitals and to find them. And every hospital, you know, there's been this search on, I think the deadline just passed a few days ago, but there was this hunt on for hospitals to be designated high-impact hospitals. They needed to have 100 COVID patients. So, like, every hospital in the country was trying to get their 100. So, you know, sometimes you create incentives and they're a little bit perverse because you hear stories about, you know, the hospitals didn't like the test they were using because they weren't getting enough positives, so they switched to a different lab that gave them more positives and all this kind of thing. And who knows what's true or not. But it certainly is the case that, you know, Medicare pays an automatic 20% bonus if a patient is coded as COVID. And so, you know, what we're seeing now, as the hospitals have opened up for a lot of other procedures in a lot of places, is, you know, they're testing everyone who comes in, they're testing everyone who comes in. And, you know, if you're in a state that has a lot of COVID circulating right now, a lot of people who don't even know they have it are going to test positive. And if you put it in as the primary diagnosis on their account, you get 20% more from Medicare. If they're not, even if they're not a Medicare patient,
yeah,
you probably
motorcycle
get more from
accident.
Insurance.
I mean, we're hearing.
Yeah, I mean, we had one in we had a death in Orange County, Florida last week, which was one of only two deaths of someone in their 20s in Orange County, and there was a local reporter who asked the county health official, did the two people in their 20s who died have pre-existing conditions, serious comorbidities? And the answer from the health official was, I know the first one didn't have any comorbidities because he died in a motorcycle accident.
Oh, there you go. I remember hearing that one, and I thought, okay.
And I don't know, they may have now taken that out of the count down there. I don't know.
Oh, I'm sure they did.
But you see a lot of these stories. But when people find out about them, maybe they do something about it. But there's a lot of these coding issues going on, and the statistics are in many ways, you know, highly questionable. But, you know, here's another Florida example I'll give you. In Miami-Dade County, one-third of all the people who come into the ER for traffic accidents, for car wrecks, are testing positive for COVID. And so, you know, when you've got such high prevalence in a community where it's sort of going around and, you know, all kinds of people who are not sick are testing positive, the hospitalization numbers can be very difficult to follow because you can have a lot of people who are there for totally unrelated reasons.
But tested positive and they're in the hospital, but it doesn't have anything to do with...
Right.
Well, the other thing, too, is, I don't see any sense in tracking how many people test positive. Who cares?
Well, if they're not sick, I agree with you. I mean, the idea that it's very interesting because, you know, we've never done something like this. And, you know, if we tested everyone, if we tested millions of tests for flu in the summer, we might find millions of positives in the off-season. But in the off-season, it doesn't make you sick. You know, and if you're not susceptible, it doesn't make you sick. So what does it mean? What is the meaning of it? And it's very interesting because I've been reading a lot about influenza-like illnesses, respiratory viruses, all this kind of stuff that, you know, I never thought I would have an interest in, but now it dominates everything in our
right.
world. So I've been reading all this stuff about it, and it's very interesting how strongly seasonal they are. And it seems, you know, it's not enough. You know, you need two things to happen to get sick with one of these diseases. One, you need to catch it from someone and be exposed to it, but that's not enough in itself. It also, you have to be susceptible to it yourself, which seems to vary by season, varies with your vitamin D levels, all these other factors. And so we really, you know, we've never run this experiment before of mass industrial scale testing of the whole, of the population, whether they're sick or not. And we don't know what's normal or not normal in terms of people, you know, testing positive for a virus when they're not sick. This could actually be pretty typical for an illness. Like, we've just never tried to find out.
We've never done mass testing before.
Well,
so
we have tens of thousands of people who die from the flu
normal.
Every year, so why don't we do that? We have to take a really quick break. When we come back, I really would like to highlight your all your research there with the Committee to Unleash Prosperity, because the stats in your document are amazing, and I hope people will go look at them, because out there right now it's just all opinion and spin, and these are actually researched facts, so I think people would really like to know about that. There's a shortage of that these days. So you can find everything about Phil Kirpin and the document we keep referencing at wethepeopleradio.us. Probably be the theme song for 2020.
Yeah,
step
we are
into the Twilight Zone.
Twilight Zone for
so,
sure.
So, to just tidy up the date from before, the congressional testimony that Phil Kirpin did was on June 11th, 2020. So it was roughly a month ago. That entire document is online. It's like 16 pages, and I would encourage you to look at it. I have it in PDF, so everybody should be able to open it and look. But like right on the, what, third page? Third and fourth page is almost one entire chart, state by state by state. It's all been updated within the last couple of months on total deaths, state deaths, COVID deaths. I mean, just, and it cites all the sources. So it's worth taking a look at because we're just getting, let's face it, a huge amount of spin on this whole thing. Phil, so with the Committee to Unleash Prosperity, because that's you're the president of that, and that was the title you were working under in that congressional hearing. What was the purpose of that? What was the broader purpose of being there? And did you think it made any difference?
Well, you know, it's pretty interesting because this was a House committee, so this was a Democrat that decided to do this, and I was a little surprised that they wanted to focus on this topic, considering that of the seven states I mentioned that all had some version of the policy of sending highly infectious patients into the nursing homes, six of them had Democratic governors, and the one Republican, Charlie Baker in Massachusetts, is a very blue state Republican. And so this was a very blue state problem, and I was a little bit surprised.
Do you think they had any clue on what you were going to say?
Oh, no, I think they did, because okay. I think it was, you know, reasonably well known. And I did, and I circulated the, but, I, you know, I was the, I was the one witness invited by the Republicans. So the other four witnesses were invited by the Democrats. So I was the sort of the one rebuttal witness. So we had, you know, the five-witness panel, although this was a virtual hearing because, you know, even though they were marching in the streets and these mass protests and everything, they didn't feel comfortable having congressional hearings in person. So we
of
did
course.
This on the,
Too scary.
We did this online. But, you know, it was pretty interesting because it became very clear immediately what the objective of the hearing was from the Democratic standpoint, and that was they wanted to blame President Trump for everything. And the whole thing was, you know, this is President Trump's fault. He didn't send enough equipment to the nursing homes. His rules weren't strict enough. He didn't warn us in time. You know, we can't blame the states. This was such a big problem. It must have been a federal responsibility. This was sort of the main theme that all the Democrats and the other witnesses were saying through the whole thing. And, you know, my rebuttal to that, of course, was that this didn't happen the same way everywhere. This was a situation where specific policy choices clearly had an enormous impact on the outcome and how severe it was. I mean, if you look nationally now at the most recent numbers, and we update these regularly, so the one you have in front of you is a little old, but, you know, we update this basically every day. If you look nationally, excluding New York, because as I said, their data is has that asterisk on it. Nationally, we've lost 2.4% of our long-term care population with COVID,
wow.
Which is not really a terrible number considering that the median months of life before death in a long-term care facility are like 5 months, and so you have a lot of old sick people. A lot of them are going to die anyway, so it's not horrendous. It's not great. It's about 2.4% is the national. But then you look at some of these states that did the worst. You've got Connecticut lost 12.8% of their long-term care population. New Jersey lost 11%.
That's a lot.
Lost 10%. Yeah, so this is not a situation where, you know, it was the federal policy response that must have been to blame. You know, this is happening everywhere. It is happening to a certain extent everywhere. But, you know, California, you've lost 1.4%. You've lost less than the national. And so, you know, it does make a difference, I think, you know, what policies governors adopt.
That 2.4%, what was the death rate prior to COVID?
It's a good question. I don't know. Unfortunately, that's been a little bit hard to track down.
Because you're right. I mean, a lot of these folks that check in, I mean, they've only got a few months to live.
And not to put too fine a point on it, but your dad was one of these people.
Oh, yeah.
He was in a care facility and contracted the virus.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because it's easy to criticize the care homes that fail to isolate someone who's returned from the hospital and then they infect other people, but the reason I think it would be so much better to have those dedicated post-acute care facilities is my dad was properly isolated, and he didn't infect anyone else after he was sent back. But the isolation was absolutely brutal for him. He was basically, like, stuck in a room for weeks and weeks on end. That was in March. He's still not walking, and it's July.
Can you go see him yet?
He's up in New York. I'm in D.C., so that's hard. My brother's been in for window visits, which... is you could talk to him through a window. That's all they allow.
Does he still test positive?
They didn't even have that until a couple weeks ago. But, you know, the isolation, even if you do it right from the standpoint of not exposing other patients, the isolation is absolutely brutal.
Sure.
And that's why I think a dedicated post-acute care where people can get up and walk around and interact with other people who are also in the same situation and therefore you're not worried about exposure would be a much better solution than what we've been doing.
Yeah, that 12%. I mean, that is a huge number. And when do you think we'll start getting the real numbers out of New York? Because I mean, they played a lot of hanky panky with the numbers.
Maybe never. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, here's the thing. This is something I am deeply disappointed in the Trump administration for. They came out and they said we're going to get real numbers from everywhere in the country. We're going to have a national data set, and the CMS, Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, said we're going to make every long-term care facility in the country report directly to us, and we're going to compile the data, and we're going to figure out, you know, how many residents died. And I thought, this is so great. I was so excited. And then they clarified that they would only require reporting from, you know, May 7th on. I don't remember the exact date, but some date in May on. And of course, you know, if you don't require retrospective reporting back to the beginning of the epidemic,
yeah,
you can't get comprehensive numbers. And for New York in particular, you know, it was mostly over by then.
Sure.
And so you can't, you know, it's almost useless. And, you know, Cuomo had his own investigation into himself by his health department, which, of course, totally exonerated him and said he did nothing wrong. And, you know, I don't know. We'll see. The state legislature is supposedly going to do some kind of oversight on him. But, you know, we'll see how serious it is. I don't know. The answer is, I don't know if we ever will see it, unfortunately. We did have a study that looked at excess mortality in New York City nursing homes that was done by some of the top nursing home scholars in the country and was recently published in, I think it was the Journal of the American Medical Association. And they found that for like the 10 weeks that were like the peak of the epidemic, the mortality rate in New York City nursing homes was 35 times what it was last year. And in Detroit, by comparison, it was only about 10 times what it was last year. And so the nursing home outbreak in New York City appears to have been three times as bad as it was in Detroit. I'm not sure we'll ever get comprehensive numbers, unfortunately, from New York, because I'm not sure there's any way to force them to do it.
Based
on what you've learned, and just as, I mean, since it involved your dad, so if people have a relative that is in a nursing home, in all this research that you did and all that, did you see some telltale signs that you should be worried about, you know, the things that should red flag people? Because you don't really know what's going on in places, and especially now that you can't visit.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, the main thing that you want is you want all of the staff to be absolutely obsessive about hand washing. You want them to be washing their hands with soap and water every time they interact with a resident, every time they touch a surface, every time they basically do anything. If they're not washing their hands 100 times a day, they're probably not washing them enough, because that's, I think, how it moves through these places is the staff go, you know, patient to patient, and they move it around that way. And
makes sense.
And that's I think the most important thing. And you know, I'm sure it gets very boring for them and very monotonous doing it over and over 100 times a day. But they have to. That's absolutely crucial. It's absolutely critical.
Check them all and make sure they have chapped hands.
Right, right.
Dead giveaway.
Right.
Oh my gosh! So, what was there something that made you look at this in particular, or did they ask you to? How did it work? Were you asked to testify about this while you were in the midst of all this, or what?
They asked me because I'd been, you know, tracking this every day and tweeting these numbers out and talking about it, and they kind of, you know, I guess I'd established myself as the keeper of these numbers and these stats because there was no real national data set before we put together our spreadsheet, and it was states had varying levels of reporting, and we sort of collected it all and put it together. And you know, it's an interesting thing because a lot of people had a sense of how bad the nursing home situation was in their own state, but they thought their state was unique, and really, no, it's pretty much bad everywhere. I mean, with only a few exceptions, it's sort of as I said, there's a continuum. You know, there's a big difference between the state that's lost 2% of its long-term care population and 10, but there's almost no place that doesn't have, you know, 40% or more of their total COVID deaths in the long-term care facilities. And so this is it's impossible to understand what this disease is without focusing on this. And of course, you know, if you just run all your headlines with the total numbers and you don't talk about the fact that half or more are in the long-term care facilities, then you do two things that do the public a huge disservice. One is they underestimate the threat to care facility residents, and two is they overestimate the threat to everyone else. Because if about 1% of the country's population has half of the deaths, that means everyone else has, you know, only half of what the headlines show, and therefore their risk assessment should probably be predicated on that.
Wow. We've got to take a break, but when we come back, I would really like to touch on the some of the legislation they've passed to more or less indemnify themselves for liability of bad choices they've made. because it spelled it out in this report pretty clearly that you can't.
I just want you to know, Phil, he was ranting and raving about that.
Yeah,
so the ranting and the raving has gone away, but
yeah.
Let's talk about the questions remain. You're listening to We the People. You can find us Tuesday and, oh, easy for me to say, what the heck, it's not up. Here we go. Tuesday and Wednesday nights at 10 p.m. here in the local Reading area on the American Uncensored Network, channel 23.7 KRDT. And you can always get our archives commercial free at wethepeopleradio.us.
I've been through everything I can try. And as I roll along, I begin to find things aren't always just what they seem. I wanna turn the whole thing upside down. I'll find the things they say just can't be found. I'll share this love I find with everyone.
I'm alright, nobody but about me. Why you got to give me a fight? Can't you just let it be?
Just like thinking about that gopher doing the little dance when he comes up out of the hole in Caddyshack when they play that song. My neighbor's yard has gopher holes. Every time I walk by, I'm like, come on, where's the little gopher when you need him? I'd love him to come out of the hole for me just one time, but nothing.
So in the report that we're reading here, Connecticut passed a liability waiver.
Yeah.
Governor Ned Lamont, Executive Order Number 7U, and
for unbelievable.
In part, it says protection from civil liability or actions or omissions in support of the state's COVID-19 response. Talk about that a little bit. I mean, that just kind of gives them, I don't know, an out.
Yeah, how's that work?
To not be responsible.
I was pretty surprised when I researched Connecticut because they're the worst of the worst in terms of the percentage of their long-term care population that died with COVID. It's 12.8%. And I thought that when I researched them, I would find Cuomo, you know, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania type must-admit order on the books to explain it. But I didn't. There was no such order. And so I was surprised, and I thought, well, maybe it's hidden somewhere. Maybe I just can't find it. And it turns out that they never had one. But in theory, they had the right policy. The governor had four facilities reopened, old disused facilities reopened, brought back up to code and so forth, and prepared to be used as COVID-only post-acute care facilities, exactly what I've been calling for. And in theory, you would think, okay, great, they did the right thing. They should have been in good shape. What went wrong? Well, those four facilities were empty. They stayed empty. No one ever went to them. They never had any patients. The company that set them up, was like pulling their hair out. Why did we build this thing? You told us it was going to be full. We have no patients. We have no revenue. And what happened instead was all of the nursing homes just accepted back all of the former residents that they had. They just readmitted them when they were clinically stable and they were discharged from the hospitals. And so they sort of ended up with kind of a de facto version of what those other states had to be ordered to do. And then you kind of wonder, well, why would they do that? You know, why would they risk infecting their other residents if they weren't ordered to do it? What would cause that decision to be made? And the only explanation I could come up with was that it was this liability waiver that essentially, you know, removed any downside for them in terms of being held responsible if they failed to contain the spread from those readmitted patients. And I think, I'm in favor of liability protection that's reasonable, because I think that, you know, there are a lot of businesses that are scared to open right now because I think if anyone in my business catches this, we're going to get sued into oblivion by the trial lawyers who are standing at the ready. And I don't think that's a good thing for getting our economy moving and our society going again. And so I've supported proposals from Mitch McConnell to do liability protection nationally. I think that's necessary. But I think that when we deal specifically with nursing homes, we need to be careful that the liability protection is crafted in such a way that they've got to follow all of the best practices and everything that we now know about this disease, and they should, if they can't segregate facilities, they need to at least segregate a floor or a wing of the building. They need to have separate air handling systems, separate staffing. They need to, you know, take all of the appropriate precautions in order to avail themselves of that protection. And I'm going to be making sure that the language on that is pretty tight, because I don't want to have a situation where, you know, you have a recurrence of facilities saying, hey, you know, maybe we're not really set up to do this the right way, but, you know, we'll take the money. There's no downside. You really want to avoid that happening. Maybe there's another explanation for Connecticut, but that's the only way I can make sense of it.
Well, that was kind of my question is okay, they have an order to protect them from past omissions and errors or whatever, but does that protect them from future actions and future omissions and future deaths?
Well, you know, I think that we know so much more about this now, and we know, and we have so much more, you know, we have copious masks and other equipment for the staff of these facilities, whereas they were in extreme short supply before. You know, I think that we're at a level now where if you're a legitimate operator, you should be able to keep these facilities safe and keep these patients segregated, the infectious ones, and we've got a tremendous amount of testing in the nursing homes as well now. And so I think we're at a point now where with a reasonably crafted liability protection, there's not much downside risk, because you would really need to have some kind of negligence of not following best procedures and policies to have a problem now, and you know, that's not going to be waived by a well-constructed waiver. You're still going to get lawsuits if that's what happens.
Yeah, and I agree. I think the trial lawyers are going to have a heyday with this no matter what, but I still think that some people need to be held accountable for some of these decisions, for putting these people at risk to start with.
Yeah, because I liked your, you know, right under the, when you first started the Connecticut tab, you said here they adopted two policies, the policy of standing up COVID-only recovery facilities and a blanket liability waiver that offered, in effect, zero risk revenue for regular nursing homes to accept infectious patients. And the conclusion, I think, is accurate. Unfortunately, the latter policy appears to have rendered the former ineffective. When you put all this into the record in the hearing, I don't know, were people surprised? Do you think anything will come of this? Was there any, I mean, was it just kind of an information thing? Or were they looking for ways to maybe fix some of this?
Well, you know, as I said,
it's kind of hard at the national level to fix the states, but I get it.
I think the Democrats were mainly trying to blame Trump, and the Republicans were mainly trying to blame the Democratic governor. So I don't think it was about solutions, unfortunately.
That's a good thing you didn't have to leave the house to do it.
Right. I did it in the backyard, actually. So I had some nice, flowers behind me and that kind of thing.
Oh, nice, nice. I particularly like the hearings where, you know, they can't figure out that they're on mute, or they have unmuted, and then they're screaming at their kids or yelling at their dog or whatever. The not in-person hearings have actually been somewhat entertaining, even though the topics aren't. So where are you going from here with your research? Are you guys going to just keep updating this and make this sort of your...
Well, we're continuing to update it, and especially now we're watching to see... if the southern states can keep it out of the nursing homes, you know, at least to a better extent than the northern states did, and prevent the really high death counts, because you know that's where things really get bad, is when you fail to keep it out of the nursing homes. And so far, as I said, you know, they certainly have nursing home deaths in the southern states, but nothing on the scale of what we saw in the north. So they seem to be doing a better job so far, and you know, we're going to keep watching it and hope that continues.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people were totally unaware that the majority of the deaths that we're hearing are from nursing homes. They're not out. They're not from people.
It's not school kids.
Yeah, it's not school kids. It's not people out on the street. You know, very high percentage of people in nursing homes make up those numbers.
Did you guys talk at all about the contrast with school-age kids?
I did a little bit in my opening because, you know, I think to really understand the shape of this pandemic, you need to understand just how steep the age stratification is. And this is a disease that overwhelmingly spares the young. And that's the positive of it. The flip side of that is it's really, really bad for old people, as I said. And, you know, rationally, we need to direct our response towards that. When you say you're going to prioritize protecting everyone, in a sense, you prioritize no one. And you get the terrible outcomes that we did in those northeastern states.
Jeez.
Yeah, if you look at the chart you gave us here, all these people are freaking out about opening up to schools. 1 to 4 years of age, 0%. 5 to 14 years of age, 0.01%. 15 to 24 years of age, 0.12%. I mean, that's almost zero.
The risk in those age categories, the risk of both hospitalization and death in those age categories, is lower than seasonal flu.
Yeah.
And so, mm-hmm. you know, if you wouldn't restrict your activities or close something for seasonal flu, in my judgment, you shouldn't close it for COVID.
Right.
With respect to those.
Yeah, we never have in the past, and that's, I think, where people need to do a little more homework, because this whole school thing is getting out of hand. I mean, people need to look at the numbers and get the kids back in school.
Yeah, the idea they're never going to school
again. I have a paper on that subject also that we can send you.
Oh, that would be great.
Yeah, we could post that.
We should let you know in the final 30 seconds. I did put a list on the site, but you're a prolific author on The Federalist too, and you have some great writing on there for people to go check out. Bill Kirpin, we are happy that we could touch base with you today and spend more than 3 minutes talking to you.
All right, have a good one.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Bill.
You have been listening to We the People. You can find us Tuesday and Wednesday nights at 10 p.m. on KRDT Channel 23.7 at wethepeopleradio.us.